started walking a little after 6 a.m. because my mom and I are going to try to do 26 miles today and reach the town of Harper's Ferry, West Virginia.
I'm Matt Podolsky, trail name Birdman. In 2022, I attempted to thru-hike the Appalachian Trail with my mom.
Okay, so I'm going to count the little bumps on the roller coaster. We did 2 yesterday. 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So I'd say 10 to 12 humps. And we're gaining maybe 500 feet elevation for each one.
The roller coaster is an infamous section of the Appalachian Trail in Virginia. Its name comes from the numerous short but steep hills that hikers must climb in this area.
You see the sign though? We're done. It's the end of the roller coaster. And, you know, we've basically got 7 hours to do 15 or so miles.
Which,
if it's like mostly flat terrain.
If it's easy, that should be fine.
Exactly.
That's my mom, Candy. Trail name, Chili Pepper Woman. After a grueling 26-mile day, my mom and I made it to Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. This town is widely known on trail as the psychological midpoint of a thru-hike, so this was a big milestone for me and my mom.
This is basically it. We did 26 miles.
We did 26 miles. I hope I don't have to do it again.
Harper's Ferry is a cultural landmark. The National Park Service manages the historic town center. This is where John Brown tried to take over the U.S. weapons arsenal in 1859. He was trying to start a revolt that would bring an end to slavery.
There in the realm's domain of John Brown and his party of raiders at Harper's Ferry.
The Appalachian Trail Conservancy has its headquarters in Harper's Ferry, and it's a tradition for thru-hikers to stop and have their picture taken in front of the historic building.
Yeah, you really can't walk much through town without tripping over some historical piece.
This is Common Land, and in this episode, we're exploring how the Appalachian Trail was finally protected, who feels comfortable on the trail, and how its history can help people connect the past to the present.
Without the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, there would be no AT. I mean, I need to, and I don't think people really realize that. So my name is Sandy Mara. I'm the president and CEO of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. I've been working on behalf of the Appalachian Trail, primarily as a volunteer, for pretty much my entire adult life. I started in my mid-20s. I met my husband working at Blackburn Trail Center. He's known as Trail Boss, so he built the roller coaster that you just hiked through.
Yeah.
So that's him. More famous than me. And we were married at Blackburn. That's where we had our wedding. And I tell people it's a family business. So that's, you know, he and I both are very passionate, and we see it as our personal legacy of trying to make the world a little bit better is the work we do.
So we've talked about the origins of the Appalachian Trail and what it took for the trail to become established, but we haven't talked about how the trail is organized today.
We took Benton McKay's vision, which really laid out this idea of this protected wilderness so that people could get away from modern society, and recognizing that the first step to really fully realizing his vision was in fact to get this footpath built. And that was this first set of volunteers that formed the initial Appalachian Trail Conference, put that on the ground.
What that first set of volunteers accomplished was nothing short of amazing. The Appalachian Trail Conference, the precursor of the modern Appalachian Trail Conservancy, was established in 1925. Just 12 years later, they had managed to create a contiguous trail running from Georgia to Maine.
And it was all handshake agreements, right? So it was either road walk or street walks, old Forest Service roads, lots and lots of private land. And it was in the late 50s and early 60s that the conference recognized that that wasn't going to be sustainable, that without a permanent protection of the land, the trail would slowly fall apart. So it was at that point that the conference recognized they needed to invite the National Park Service and the U.S. government in to protect the land.
In the 1960s, two things are happening. The first is development in the woods, in the mountains, that is interfering with the property that the trail runs over. And so the trail is having to be detoured off of lands that it used to be on and instead running over road shoulders.
That's Philip Denieri, author of The Appalachian Trail, a biography.
The second thing that's going on in the early to mid-1960s is the beginnings of what would be called the environmental movement. And those two trends basically came together at a cocktail party in Washington, D.C. in 1963. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, who knows nothing about the AT, but is a leading voice of what would become environmentalism. In fact, he would go on to create Earth Day in 1970. Nelson is very interested in protecting the environment, in particular, protecting spaces where we can enjoy and appreciate the natural environment. Nelson has those sensibilities. He hears from somebody at this cocktail party who is a doctor in the DC area and is involved in the local chapter of his local Appalachian Trail Club. And he mentions to Nelson the fact that the trail is falling apart. And Nelson is a new, young, progressive, ambitious, perhaps even naive senator. And he says, well, maybe we can get the federal government to step in and protect it. And I'm going to introduce a bill to do so. There's a lot of legislative history that follows, but the result is in 1968, the National Trails System Act, which commits the federal government through the, at that point, very reluctant National Park Service to create and protect these long-distance trails. It gets off to a very rocky start, but eventually the administration of Jimmy Carter in 1977 and 1978 reanimates the federal commitment to the trail, gets the Park Service going on it, and along with some legislative partners, leads the effort to create a funding source to buy up land so that the trail can have a corridor to run through. There just would not be an AT nowadays if the Park Service hadn't made a very narrow national park to contain the trail and to protect the trail. I don't think most folks realize that.
We got funding to then for the Park Service to undertake what ended up being its largest land acquisition program ever. And that then, it created the 1,000-foot corridor on either side of the treadway. And we didn't reach final protection until, you know, early 2000s.
The Appalachian Trail had become more than just a footpath connecting Georgia to Maine. It was now a national park of a rather unusual shape, 2,200 miles long and 1,000 feet wide. Inspiring as that history is, the story of how the Appalachian Trail was made and who made it can also tell us a lot about who had access to the vision its founders imagined.
The AT really is a product of the white 20th century middle class seeking a recreational outlet that granted them authenticity they couldn't get in the day-to-day urban and suburban world. That's what we need to acknowledge the AT is, as opposed to some organically occurring natural feature.
This is most obvious when you look at the history of the Appalachian Trail Conservancy, or ATC, the group responsible for establishing and protecting the trail. Back in the 1920s and 30s, the ATC held a number of their meetings at Shenandoah National Park.
Shenandoah was a segregated park until after the passage of the Scenic Trails Act.
That's Mills Kelly, professor of history at George Mason University.
Black people could go to the park, but they had to be all the way down in the south end of the park, the furthest distance from D.C. And so, ATC held their annual meetings there, and there's no discussion of, like, what does this mean? Because they didn't think about it. And so there's that, it's sort of casual racism in that sense, or institutional racism. It was just kind of how it was.
That exclusion rippled across the decades, and its impact can still be seen on the trail today. Over 90% of Appalachian Trail thru hikers are white, and reports of racist behavior on the trail continue to this day. But this is slowly starting to change. New organizations are working to make outdoor spaces like the Appalachian Trail more welcoming for all, and they're also setting the record straight about how their history connects them to the trail. We'll explore some of these histories after a short break. Hey there, adventurers. Are you ready to hit the trail this season? If so, check out Big Agnes, the mother of comfort. Whether you're backpacking, car camping, or sleeping under the stars in your backyard, Big Agnes gear is built for comfort without compromise. Their award-winning sleeping bags, pads, and tents are lightweight, durable, and feel like home, no matter where you roam. Say goodbye to cold, stiff nights, and hello to plush, cozy sleep in the wild or your backyard. Find Big Agnes at an outdoor retailer near you or at bigagnes.com and feel the difference. Big Agnes, comfort built for the backcountry.
All right, it's June 29th, 2022, which means I've been out here hiking the Appalachian Trail for exactly 3 months.
We're back. This is Common Land, a show about the Appalachian Trail. I'm Matt Podolsky, and you just heard some audio that I recorded during my attempt to thru-hike the entire Appalachian Trail with my mom.
I'm getting very close to the Pennsylvania border, which means I'm about to cross the Mason-Dixon line. Oh, look, and this is it. I'm right here. Mason-Dixon line. Maryland, Pennsylvania. I'm here. We've got just a simple wooden marker sign here at the border, and then right next to it is a mailbox, and then inside we've got a logbook.
You know how everybody has been saying that, like, Harper's Ferry is like the psychological midpoint of the trail,
yeah.
Even though it's not the actual midpoint,
right,
by mileage. As I approached the Mason-Dixon line, I was like, no, this is the psychological midpoint. I grew up in the Northeast, and there's a certain kind of stigma towards the South that has been ingrained in me. In those first few months on the trail, simple things like souvenir Confederate flags for sale at convenience stores were a regular reminder that I was well outside of my comfort zone. This is not to say that I experienced any kind of ill will or animosity from anyone that I encountered. Quite to the contrary, I experienced a kind of selfless generosity that is rare in the Northeast where I grew up. But I also know that as a white guy, my experience in Southern Appalachia was quite different from that of others.
The Appalachian Trail runs through a lot of areas that are, like, not so friendly towards Black and Brown and queer folks.
That's Brittany Levitt, outdoor educator and guide and the CEO of Brown Girls Climb.
Our whole focus is really unpacking what we call like unplaqued facts. So these are the facts that don't have like little pictures along the trail or things like that. And so really focusing on the things that aren't in our history books, but are significant to the area. When we're talking about our communities, and I'm going to say specifically the Black community, there aren't that many plaques.
In the fall of 2016, Brittany led a four-day backpacking trip along the Appalachian Trail, specifically designed for members of the organization Outdoor Afro.
Outdoor Afro is a national organization that creates space of supporting joy in the Black community in the outdoors while also intertwining our history in the outdoors. This probably was maybe my second year of being an Outdoor Afro leader. Each year they did like a very historic hike called Black Packers, which focused on doing a hike somewhere, but also having that area be significant to Black history. So one of the other program leaders who was there was like, we want to do something around the history of Harriet Tubman. And well, there's a ton of history because Harriet Tubman's born in Maryland and used a lot of like the East Coast along the way to help enslaved folks make it to the North, doing a lot of backpacking, and she used the Appalachian Mountains as part of one of her many routes to the North.
She wouldn't have been able to make all of those journeys outbound in return if she did not have an intimate relationship to and knowledge of the landscape.
That's Tony Cohen, a historian and expert on the Underground Railroad.
She was really able to read the land, and in the moments where it most mattered, while in bondage, being able to gain sustenance from the land. Slavery never offered the enslaved enough to get by. So people had to go out on the land to supplement their diets and their clothing and their housing.
Tony's path to becoming a historian began with an interest in his family tree.
I'm African American, but I have a Jewish last name.
Tony discovered that his great-grandfather, who was born in Philadelphia, was orphaned just before the Civil War. A Jewish family from Delaware adopted him, and his last name became Cohen.
And that was the most incredible thing I ever heard about my family history, and it just launched me on this journey, if you will, of genealogy, interviewing people in my family, and trying to figure out and confirm not only that story, but a history that I had up until that time not really paid any attention to.
Tony was inspired to pursue history at American University and spent 6 months working on a research project about the Underground Railroad, uncovering 6 routes of escape and documenting 3 safe houses in his home county in Maryland.
Then in 1996, I decided to take 2 months while I was between jobs and retrace one of the routes that I had documented, which I did by walking from Maryland to Canada. 2 months, 5 states, over 800 miles, stopping in the towns along the way and asking people what they knew. And that was really the first steps, which led to my current career, so to speak. I kind of stumbled into it, if you will.
Tony's 1996 trip along one of the routes of the Underground Railroad led him down a career path focused on experiential learning, and he's been seeking ways to give people an experience-based understanding of history, and the Underground Railroad in particular, ever since. Tony's long-distance hike along the Underground Railroad was very different from an Appalachian Trail through hike. But there were some interesting similarities, and Tony was eager to compare our experiences.
When you got to... I know this is your interview, but here we go. When you got back from your walk, how long did it take you to re-assimilate?
That was 2 years ago, and I'm still re-assimilating. You know what I mean? Like, it was a transformative experience, and I don't view the world in the same way, so...
Something that I experienced when I got back, I've never gotten the right word for it, but I think it was grief. And I would even say it's possible that I felt or experienced something akin to depression. And I just felt something had forever changed in me.
A lot of people talk about post-trail depression. A lot of people experience depression after they're done with their through hike. You experience this very different lifestyle, and then you just get thrown back into the modern world at the end of it. And, you know, a lot of people aren't ready for that. You know, I mean, I wasn't entirely ready for it. Although Tony's Underground Railroad route took him through landscapes with a lot of similarities to the Appalachian Trail, the Underground Railroad and the Appalachian Trail don't overlap in a literal way.
There was some legend that Harriet Tubman had used the Appalachian Trail. We now know that's not true, but certainly the AT would give anyone traveling it with the Underground Railroad in mind a sense of what that would have been like.
And this history has helped Tony and others reclaim their historical relationship with the natural world.
Even though we wouldn't call the majority of these folks environmentalists today, they have environmental lessons to teach us, which I think makes them environmentalists.
Like Tony's Underground Railroad hike, Brittany Levitt's outdoor Afro trip along the Appalachian Trail was an experiential journey that blended hiking with history.
The trail itself goes through Civil War history, and like specifically in the Maryland, Virginia area, like where we started literally on the line of the Mason-Dixon line.
While the goal of Tony's trip was to follow the thread of history as closely as possible, the backpacking trip that Brittany led on the Appalachian Trail was about more than just history. It was about introducing people to hiking and backpacking.
So I was like, well, we could do the Maryland section, because Maryland section is the shortest. It's like 40 miles. And we could break it down into like a full like 4-day trip. Because I think it's important to not only have folks who are experienced hikers, but also have folks who are introducing themselves into backpacking and what that looks like. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There are 6 folks that ended up going on this trip, and it was all intergenerational, which was also really cool, and also very expanded of the different levels of experiences from backpackers. Yeah, it was a very, very interesting, but really fun experience to be able to do that. And then also to show people my favorite sections of the Appalachian Trail, because yeah, Maryland is still my home. And being able to hike through and like pinpoint certain spots and share like history was really awesome.
Brittany's group set off from the Mason-Dixon line and made it to Harper's Ferry 4 days later. This made sense as an endpoint for the hike. Harper's Ferry isn't just home to the Appalachian Trail Conservancy. It's a historical landmark that played a crucial role in African American history. In October of 1858, John Brown led an armed party of 22 into the town of Harper's Ferry. Their goal was to overtake the U.S. weapons arsenal and instigate a revolt that would bring an end to slavery. Brown had been planning this raid for months. Harriet Tubman actually helped by recruiting formerly enslaved people, but ultimately didn't join the raid itself. Brown's party did briefly take control of the U.S. Armory, but they were soon overtaken by a much larger company of U.S. Marines. John Brown was captured, convicted of treason, and hanged. Although Brown failed to instigate a slave rebellion, his raid set into motion a number of events that led to the Civil War. Brown's raid and subsequent execution energized the abolitionist movement in the North while strengthening the desire for secession in the South.
Okay, so you swore at the snake.
I swore at the snake.
That's my mom describing another encounter with a timber rattlesnake.
Tell me exactly what you said to the snake.
I said, you f- get away from me.
Okay, so you called him a f-?
I did.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, he was coming after me. and I let him know that he was not to do that.
Man, you need some good luck like this for bear sightings.
Uh-huh. That's the thing. I see all kinds of wildlife, just not bears. The bears don't like me. And I would be okay with the rattlesnakes not liking me. That would be okay. But I would like to see a bear.
Just a few miles after my mom's timber rattlesnake sighting, we set up camp at a tent site just outside of Boiling Springs, Pennsylvania. Boiling Springs was the first of several towns that the AT would take us through in Pennsylvania. And as we entered this mid-Atlantic region of the AT, we would be walking in much closer proximity to human development and infrastructure. As was evident from our night at the tent site in Boiling Springs, which was located right alongside a railroad line.
But yeah, I got a recording of that train on my phone because I was like, that's so insanely loud. I have to document it.
I didn't have my hearing aids on and it was so loud it hurt my ears.
Yeah. I mean, what did it come, like, six times?
Something like
yeah.
that.
The trail in Pennsylvania weaves through the center of several small towns, like Boiling Springs, that have roots in the early days of the Industrial Revolution. But despite the trail's proximity to more developed and populated areas throughout this region, the path itself remains rugged and difficult, as I'll find out in the next episode.
Some sections of the trail are just boulder fields.
Also, in our next episode, we'll learn about a few of the first through hikers and how the attention that one hiker brought to the trail may have saved it from obscurity. Common Land is a production of the Wildlands Collective. This season was produced in partnership with New Hampshire Public Radio. This episode was produced by me, your host, Matt Podolsky. Music is by Blue Dot Sessions. To listen to the next episode in the series, just search for Common Land in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about the show and to see a full list of credits, go to commonlandpodcast.com.